Philosophy and Computers, San Jose State, and today is October 5th? October 6th. And today I want to talk about the second half of Chapter 3. Well, there's actually three things in Chapter 3 that I want to talk about. I want to say a little, last time I forgot to say anything about homeostasis, and I meant to say a little bit about that. And then I want to talk about artificial life and about evolution. Remember last time I said we can think of life as being made of three components: self-reproduction, homeostasis, and morphogenesis. And self-reproduction is, in some ways, that's DNA does that for us for free. And looking ahead to thinking about artificial life, which we will be thinking about in a little bit, reproducing in artificial life can be fairly easy. If you think of a computer program, it's easy enough to have a program make a copy of itself or to have a process fork. So having a robot reproduce is a little harder. We'll get into that a little bit later today. Morphogenesis, what we found, that's something that nature does really well. Last time I talked about reaction diffusion systems, Alan Turing was maybe the first person to notice that these systems, they're good at growing organic-looking shapes, things like spots and stripes and ridges and branches and swirls and embryos and beans and all these nice organic shapes. That's something getting computer things to grow into shapes, it's not so clear how to do that. Now, homeostasis is the property that an organism has to keep itself healthy and keep itself in good repair. Homeostasis kind of leads to chaos in the following sense. You can see this. This is a pretty simple experiment you can do. If you have more than two drives, if you have three or more drives, satisfying those drives seems most of the time to lead to chaotic behavior. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, if you're only trying to satisfy one drive, like to be at a certain temperature, then you can kind of home in on the region where the temperature is that level, and if the temperature goes up, you move somewhere cooler. If it goes down, you move somewhere warmer. And you can kind of home in on that and kind of settle in and everything's fine. When you have two drives, sometimes there will be sort of a kind of an oscillation. You'll be satisfying one, that'll push you away from the other, then you can come back, and you'll often end up traveling around an ellipse in phase space. Now, three drives, a good example of that, there used to be a toy they used to sell a lot in the 60s, and you would have a little pendulum hanging down. At the bottom would be sort of a magnet. And then, so what the pendulum wanted to do was to be straight down. So gravity was pulling it towards the center. Now, the thing they would do to make it exciting would be to put, Well, we spend a lot of time taking care of our machines. It's sort of like babysitting them, feeding them. Yeah, I think stereo comes out better on the podcast. Anyway, what I was talking about, I'm talking about this idea that when you have more than two drives, you get chaotic behavior. And the classic example is you have a pendulum hanging down, and then you have a square under it. And if I put a little magnet here, if you only have one magnet, then this is a system with two drives, because on the one hand, the pendulum wants to hang towards the center. On the other hand, it's being attracted towards the magnet a little bit. So it'll sort of pull over here, maybe, and settle down. Okay. Now, what's actually more interesting is if I put a repulsive magnet. So then the thing will kind of go away from the magnet, and it'll sort of kind of settle down there, maybe. Now, what happens when you put two negative magnets, then you've got three drives. It's trying to avoid these two. It's trying to hang by the center. And if you look down on the screen and you watch the thing moving, it'll tend to move in this sort of endless, chaotic bouncing around. And it's homeostasis, and it's trying to satisfy itself. You've got a computational system. So as people say, computational systems don't have intentions. Well, this has three intentions. To hang down straight, to avoid this spot, and to avoid this spot. It has these intentions, and trying to satisfy all three leads to chaotic behavior. So, and that's there's a program you can look at. I don't feel like running it right now. It's called the Chaos Program. That's a program I wrote when I was at Autodesk. James Glick had this best-selling book called Chaos. It came out about, the early 1990s. And then I was working at Autodesk, and we wrote some software to go with that book. And one of the, that was the first program I ever wrote in C. It was a good job, because I was really fairly incompetent as a programmer. I was just learning how to do it. But they let me do it, because they thought it was fun to watch me flounder around. And they enjoyed talking to me, and you know, when the program was done, it was kind of cool to look at. Though the code is pretty nasty. But anyway, but you can run it and see it, or you can play with these toys. And so that just sort of tells you something that, again, this is one of these cases, one of the themes that I come back to over and over in the book. We can have a system that's deterministic computation, but that doesn't mean that it's predictable. And predictable in the sense that there's no quick way. If I set this bob loose here, there's no really, and I say, where is it going to be? Which quadrant is going to be in after a minute? There's probably no good way to figure that out much faster than simulating the thing step by step, running a whole minute's worth of time. There's not going to be any t-shirt type formula that's going to give you the answer. Because it's this gnarly computation that nature's performing there. It's an unpredictable, naturally occurring computation. So, okay. Now, one other thing I talk about in the homeostasis section, I mentioned the fact that obviously your mind is going to be even, you know, a lot more complicated than a pendulum bob and two magnets. I mean, there's lots of things that you want to do and lots of things you don't want to do. And your mental state kind of bounces around in this very complex orbit over time. And you have very little ability to predict what it's going to do. And that's this is one of these cases where, if you're in the right frame of mind, at least, if you take the computational worldview, this sort of makes reality more bearable. I mean, sometimes you say, well, why am I so unhappy? You know, I'm doing something wrong. Well, no, you're just unhappy today because that's where you are in the state space, and you're moving around. You're going to be somewhere else tomorrow. You don't have to do anything drastic just because you're unhappy. You know, you don't have to buy something expensive, you know, or get drunk, you know, or whatever. It's just you're unhappy today. Tomorrow will be different. And so it's a way of maybe accepting a little bit the fact that your moods are very, very changeable. So I think that's all. One other thing to remark with about homeostasis is that machines at present are really bad at homeostasis. But I'll talk about that more in the context of artificial life. So let's get into artificial life now. What is artificial life? Well, there's been this sort of ancient dream of people of building, you know, live machines. There's this old myth, a Jewish myth called about the golem, about some guys in Prague, and they make a man out of mud, and then they get some special stuff from the temple, and they zap it, this mud creature, and he comes alive and starts doing stuff. and all these myths and stories we have about robots. I should mention, by the way, you know there's a big robot expo in the convention center. If you just go down San Carlos Street, it's $20 to get on the floor. I think I might go there tomorrow and look at it. They've got also basically anybody who's making robots. The best-selling robot right now is the Roomba. That's that thing. It's like a vacuum cleaner. It bounces around your room. It can't deal with fringes on rugs. That's the worst thing for it. There's another robot, the Aibo, the robot dog. But Sony's not pushing that very hard anymore. They're sort of, well, they cost so much. And there's another guy, a Canadian guy, who's making cheaper robots that you can play with. Last year he made the Robo Sapien, and this year he's making a robot dinosaur. Yeah. So, yeah, it weighs 90 pounds. You saw some of them running around?
No. It was the demo was kind of more batteries.
Oh, like the
buttons, and it was kind of like,
yeah. Well, I might go over tomorrow and check it out. So that's one idea of artificial life, is making robots or things that are alive. Another, you might say, there's like biological artificial life. You know, can we? There's people that are saying, well, we can almost figure out how to hand build the DNA of some little worm, like kind of synthesize this in a way that would we have made life. And the story of Frankenstein, not everybody knows, the actual name of the researcher was Frankenstein. Okay, sometimes we call the monster Frankenstein, but that was really Frankenstein's monster. And it doesn't really describe in that book what he did. It just said, he sort of got a bunch of gross pieces of dead people and stuck them together and then put electricity through them. Yeah, the big switch, the Jacob's ladder. And other form of artificial life is say, well, you know, let's not get hung up on the hardware. Can we make computer programs that act like they're alive? And you'll see like virtual fish tank where you see things like fish swimming around, or there were those pets that were popular a few years ago that you would carry around on your keychain. And in every case, it's what can we do? And it's sort of subjective for people to think it's alive. But generally, they're sort of looking for something that's self-reproducing. The morphogenesis is fairly weak on these things. Generally speaking, in artificial life programs, in a computer at least, there's some limited number of possibilities, and you're giving it the genes. Let me back up a little, though, and say more about artificial life self-reproduction. If I'm talking about a computer program, well, usually you can think of it this way. Generally speaking, for most artificial life programs, you have this sort of kind of standard software. You might say something like be an ant, okay, or be a virtual ant. And then what you do is we feed into that standard software a bunch of params, okay, a bunch of parameters. And these parameters sort of act like the DNA. And this was something, when I worked at Autodesk, another product I worked on was called Artificial Life Lab. And that was actually a virtual ant farm. So we had, it was sort of like an ant farm. We had a lot of little creatures running around doing stuff. And each of them was in some way running the same kind of be a virtual ant software. But each of them had its own little DNA, and its DNA would be a lot of parameters you could set. Like, What they actually were was two-dimensional Turing machines, and maybe I'll demo some of those guys for you in a minute. The program that showed them was called, it's called Boppers. That's another program you can download for free. And yeah, maybe I'll fire up and show you a couple of those guys. So the idea was, the way they reproduced, you would simply say, well, we're in sort of an object-oriented environment. We'd say, let's just create another object, okay, kind of code object, and let's get a copy of this DNA or these parameters and just copy that over here. So that's one way to reproduce. So in computer code, reproducing is pretty easy because all you're doing is copying some code. Now you might say, maybe you should be copying the whole thing. Well, that's another approach. There's this guy who made the Galapagos program. Let's see, Carl Sims. And I mentioned it a little while earlier, I think a couple of lectures ago. He would actually have the whole program be the DNA, and then you would just copy the whole program. And these would be sort of a limited language, a limited sort of scheme-like, logo-like language. And you could just take this block of code that generates some graphics and then just make another copy of it, and that's how you would reproduce the thing. Now, originally, there was the question, well, that's, you're making it easy for yourself if you assume you have this computer, but could I make an actual robot that reproduces himself? And that was something they were wondering about in the 1940s. In fact, John von Neumann, one of the first guys to help design a computer, that was a question that intrigued him. Could we make self-reproducing machines? And at first, you might think, well, maybe not. And the reason there is usually, if you go to a factory, the machine's making stuff, usually the machine is more complicated than the stuff it makes. Like if you look at a machine that's making a gear for a watch, it'll be this, you know, large lathe, or, and it's got all these adjusting screws on it, it's got all these cutters and everything, and all that's coming out is a little gear. So you might think, well, maybe machines have to make things that are kind of simpler than themselves. But then von Neumann said, well, we could basically do it like biology does. We could say, suppose I have a machine, and let's suppose that the machine has, you know, hands and screwdrivers and wrenches and eyes, and also suppose that it has a list of instructions for how it was made. And then the idea would be, the way the machine would reproduce itself, it would say, okay, I'll get my list of instructions here, and one thing I'll do, first I'll make a copy of it. So I'm going to Xerox the instructions. So I'm going to make the new list of instructions. And now I'm going to build a new machine that owns this list of instructions. So I'm going to use my list of instructions in two ways. First of all, I'll Xerox it. And secondly, I'll read it. And I'll use it as a list of instructions. And I'll go and get the pieces that it says, and I'll put them together one by one, and, you know, go find all the stuff I need to get and put it, assemble it, and then attach this, and then I will have reproduced myself. And so this is actually, that's how DNA works. Because the DNA builds the cell. So first the DNA gets copied, it makes a new set of instructions, but also these instructions can be read by the cell, and they're used to build up all the proteins that are in the cell. And he wasn't sure that he had a proof. And then he got together with this guy called Ulam, Stan Ulam. He built a computer called the Maniac. He was a cool guy. Stan Ulam invented the hydrogen bomb. Okay, this guy was heavy duty. Though Edward Teller got a lot of the credit, but that was more of a political thing. Stan Ulam actually had the idea. Does that mean he was a bad person? Well, at the time, it seemed like a good idea to invent the hydrogen bomb. They thought it would make us safer. Anyway, Ulam had the idea. He said,
Let's do a cellular automaton. But they didn't have the word cellular automaton yet. Because von Neumann had this sort of vague idea. He said, what if you had a lake and you had a bunch of machine parts floating in it? Could a machine swim around and assemble the pieces? And he got hung up on, there's so many details, you know. And Ulam said, well, let's think of a plane of cells, and each cell has some part number in it, okay? And it turns out, they figured out, if they could have the part numbers range from 0 to 28, it turns out they only needed 29 parts. There's a certain kind of pattern they could set up, and then there's an update rule where each part will, depending on what kind of part it is, it might be an attacher where it automatically attaches the cell to the left and the cell to the right, takes these two, or copies this guy into here, and the various rules these things would do, and they showed they could make a self-reproducing pattern in this world. And that's a little bit different from just saying, I'm just going to copy the code. This is more of a little more getting into a little morphogenesis. They're saying, I'm going to reproduce and I'm actually going to build the body of my child. So that was kind of intriguing. And then people said, well, if you're going to make a cellular automaton with a self-reproducing pattern, then this guy called Chris Langton had an idea for a much simpler pattern that reproduces in a cellular automaton. And I could show you that too, except now my laptop's hibernating because I didn't touch it. You're not going to touch me? I'm going to turn off. Okay. Well, I'll turn it back on. Okay. So, the self-reproduction thing, it can work. I got really interested in this idea myself in the 80s, and the first science fiction novel I published was called Software, and that was about some robots that live on the moon, and what they've done is they've built a factory, and what they're making in that factory is more robots. So it's like in Detroit, we have these big Unimation robots that build the cars, and so then actually, in Japan, there's a Unimation factory, and it's run by Unimation robots. So it's actually a realistic scenario, having robots building more robots. And then the idea was, okay, the robots are self-reproducing, and originally the people that sent them up there had expected the robots to do stuff for them, but the robots evolve, at least in my story that happens, and they become conscious, and then, of course, they don't want to do what people ask them to. Why would any intelligent person obey orders by a general? So they rebel, and then there's not exactly a war with us, but they sort of have different wants than what the humans want. Actually, in my novel, there's this man who designed the robots, and he's getting old and he's sick. And to do him a favor, they decide to eat his brain and get the software out of his brain so they can put the software in his brain onto a robot body. And that works out not all that well for him, but it does sort of work. Okay, now I'm trying to show you now. I turned on the program Cell Lab, and I'm trying to show you this. The projector's not plugged in. High tech, okay. Okay. It's too much trouble to edit out the really stupid things that I do from the podcast. Okay. What if you could edit your whole life? There's a movie about that recently. I haven't seen it. It's called Final Cut. It was with Robin Williams. But it's a guy, his job, people record their whole life, and then after they die, he does the final cut of their life and edits it so their life looks coherent and that they did everything right. Okay, let's try turning this thing on again. There we go. Okay, the thing I want to show you now, I want to show you Langton's self-reproducing automaton. And as long as we've got the projector on, I want to show you the Boppers program too. Okay, we're getting the start screen. That's a step in the right direction. There we go. Okay, maybe I better turn the lights out. This, unfortunately, is not a very big picture. So this is Langton's pattern. And Langton's rule has, I think there's 16 states, if I recall. He published this thing in a paper. I remember when we wanted to put this rule into this program, so I had to go find the paper and then copy all these weird little numbers out of his paper. And it was kind of exciting that the rule worked. So let's start it up now. So what we had was this Q pattern, and what you see, the Q is reproducing itself. It grows, this kind of tip grows around, and then when it runs back into itself, it pinches off. And what's left inside, this is sort of dead, these squares, and it's growing on the outside. So it's sort of like a coral reef, where we have a coral reef is made up of living polyps that live on the outside, and what's left inside is just sort of calcium. So that's Langton's self-reproducing cube. Langton's quite an interesting character. He organized what I think was probably the most exciting conference I ever went to. It was called the First Artificial Life Conference. And I had just recently gotten into computers and cellular automata, and they held it in Los Alamos, which is where Ulam invented the hydrogen bomb, and it's where they first did all this work. And this was one area that they were looking at, cellular automata that have self-reproducing patterns. And the thing that's racing around inside the queue, that's sort of like the DNA for this thing. That's basically a list of instructions that's telling it what to do. Now notice this world wraps around, so it suffocates itself. We get, it's the kind of like the logistic growth rule. As it reaches its carrying capacity, and it can't go any further. As long as we've got the screen on here, let me show you the Boppers program, which is kind of nice. Let's see. I think that would be... No. Be in main data. Science. Boppers. Okay.
Space Invaders 4D.
Space Invaders?
Space Invaders 4D.
Oh, you can't see that. Okay. All right, you can see Space Invaders 4D later. Okay. That's a project one of my students did. But this is these are the Boppers. And so these guys are, they're our virtual ants. And this is a little world. And there's three colonies. There's the red colony, the blue colony, and the green colony. And they're trying to evolve. In each colony, there's a set of genes. Now, this is something I haven't talked about yet, but I might as well start talking about it now, is evolution. Because the characteristic thing in these artificial life programs, each of these is kind of what I outlined before. There's this sort of be an ant rule, and then each of them has a set of parameters. And what they're trying to do is tweak their parameters so they'll get better at essentially running into the other guys. In a sense, the red ones, you can think of them as cows, and they want to eat the green ones, which you can think of as grass. And the blue ones, they're aliens that come to Earth to slaughter the cattle. Okay, so they're trying to find the red ones. And what we're doing here is every 50 generations or so, each of them is tracking how well he's doing. Okay, so every 50 generations or so, we're killing off the less successful ones and replacing them by mutations of the more successful ones. Now, there's actually three things you need for evolution in general, in the real world or in a computer. One you need for things to be able to reproduce, to make copies of themselves. The second thing, you need variation, so you don't just have one thing making endlessly many copies of itself. Like that Q creature we were looking at, there's no evolution there because he's just endlessly making the same thing over and over again. So you want to have variation. And the third thing that you need is natural selection. Or it doesn't have to be called natural selection. It could just be selection. There's some selection principle, or another way to put it is a fitness function. So the second two things, the variation, sometimes you can think of variations. There's different ways we can vary the offspring. One is to just simply mutate, so have one have a couple of children, and then you just flip a few of the bits in this this sort of artificial DNA that it has. Another way to do it is to do sexual combination, which is to say, let's say two of them, and we could say, here's the DNA for one, here's the DNA for the other. Let's choose some splitting point, and then let's take the first half of the mother's DNA and the second half of the father's DNA, and let's let that be the child. And that's when we reproduce, that's what we do. But we don't do it just in one spot. The DNA divides up into, I don't know, is it 26 genes that people have? I can't. 26 chromosomes, yeah. Yeah. And each chromosome does the crossover. You get the father's chromosome and the mother's chromosome, and you take half the father's chromosome, half the mother's chromosome. And so you actually have, there's 26 different shuffles. And that's enough choice for variation. So, again, but you can also use mutation and just go ahead and zap a single one. But you might, briefly speaking, you might say it's sex and death that we're using. We're using sex for the variation, and death, the fact that after 50 generations here, I'll take, maybe I've got 16 of these guys, I'll kill the lowest scoring four, and I'll replace them by copies of the highest scoring four, or by sexual combinations of the highest scoring four. And we get a little bit of evolution happening here. I will say, in this world, the evolution doesn't work. I remember when my boss at that time at Autodesk and I, we were excited about this. We thought, well, we'll leave this running over the weekend and we'll come in and the ants will be, they'll be talking to us, you know, they'll be writing out words. And they sort of just kept doing what they're doing now. I mean, they might get a little bit better at it, but it's not that they... The sort of kinds of behavior that was possible for them were in some sense already predetermined by the sort of container software, the Be a Virtual Ant software. So that's a sort of weakness in a lot of artificial life programs, in that you've sort of predetermined the range of possibilities, and it's not necessarily a very interesting range. In nature, they're like you're growing proteins, you're growing these natural forms. There seems to be a sort of much, much more rich world of possibilities.
What's happening that I don't understand? Like, for example, the green ones are getting eaten by the red ones, so they should be trying to avoid red ones, right? But I see green ones often running right into red ones.
Well, they don't see at any distance. They only see the cell that they're standing on. So if you're green and you run into a red cell, you're like, oh, I shouldn't be here. I should do something else. But they don't look ahead. They don't have any vision. They're more like slugs, and they're interacting with each other's trails. I can show you some guys. There's another type of guy that has a little more vision here. And these were the... the birds. I think bird cage. Yeah. It's funny now when you look at this, it runs way too fast. When we were building this software in the 90s, we couldn't imagine that it would ever run too fast. Because just to get it to do anything, So I stupidly, I mean, later I learned over the years to check your system clock and control the update speed of your simulation so that it doesn't, it'll run the same speed on different machines. But like I said, I was just starting when I was at Autodesk. I was pretty naive, and I didn't know about doing that. But it's kind of neat to look at anyway. So here again, these guys, they do have vision. They can see where the other ones are, and they're doing flocking behavior. And we're going to talk about flocking a little bit more when we get into the next chapter, actually chapter 5, when we talk about society. But notice here they're inside a world. So each of them has the drives of... So right now we're looking at boppers, and I loaded the file called birdcage, birdcage.bl. And if you let them run, they'll get better at doing whatever they're doing, which again, they're sort of chasing each other. This is circular. Tag. The reds are chasing the greens are chasing the blues are chasing. One thing you can do to slow it down, we can make it be 3D. So if I open the params, I think fat birds. Yeah, let's try the fat birds file. Yeah, these are a little more reasonable. So this is actually in a 3D world. And there's these nice emergent things that happen. They'll get into these double helix kinds of patterns. Again, example. This is a good example of computational gnarl. I mean, that's gnarly, right? That's very gnarly. But it's completely deterministic. And if I put it in the same start condition, the same thing would happen. Okay. Anyway, let's say a little more about evolution. I think I'll turn this off now. Or should I leave that on? It's sort of pretty to look at, isn't it? Kind of hypnotic. We used to dream, at Autodesk, that we were, again, my boss was this really good guy, Eric Lyons. And we would try to think of ways we could make money with this software. This is back in the 90s when you could actually sometimes still get people to actually buy software on a disk that wasn't. I mean, people now, they'll buy Office or they'll buy Photoshop, but they won't buy much else. And this was like kind of entertainment, educational software, and we were trying to sell it for, I think, $40. And we sold some, but it was, I mean, compared to Autodesk's main business, which was selling AutoCAD, this was clearly not a moneymaker. So I didn't work there that long. Their stock price went down, and I think I mentioned that before. They were like, you know, what are these guys doing? You know, what is this? This doesn't have anything to do with designing gas stations, you know. So, but it was fun while it lasted. Anyway, the thing about evolution is a kind of a search method. Sometimes, I mentioned the other day, I was sort of beating up on the intelligent design people. And they say, well, evolution couldn't possibly have found something as wonderful as a human being in just a million years. And particularly if they say the Earth is only 6,000 years old, the chances are even less. I mean, how could evolution... Evolution is not that good of a search method. And part of what they're saying is true. Evolution is not really that great of a search method. Here's the problem. Suppose that I'm looking, and maybe something like with like these birds here that we're looking, they have like a dozen real number parameters. And so if you're going to look at every possible bird, there's like 10 to the 120th of them. And that's a lot. In fact, this guy, Seth Lloyd, has made an interesting estimate that if we let the whole universe run, viewed the whole universe as a computation, it probably hasn't yet had time to perform 10 to the 120th computations. So we can't exhaustively search this space. Okay? There's too many things in it to search the space. So then how do I find some things that act in a nice way? Well, that's where the idea is, there's different methods we have for searching really, really big spaces. And one method is called hill climbing. And in hill climbing, we take some parameters and you say, well, let's, like here I've got maybe, suppose I've got 100 bits in the DNA for this bird. So let's try flipping successively each of the 100 bits and then evaluate how that bird does. And then let's take the one that did the best of those 100 variations. And it's sort of, they call it hill climbing in the sense that even if you're blind, if you're on a landscape, you can say, well, I'll take a step to the north, and was that a step up or a step down? I'll take a step to the east, a step to the west, a step to the south. So you move one step in each direction, and you say, well, which step made me go up the most? Okay? And then you say, well, that's the direction uphill, so I'll go that direction. And then you do the same thing again, and so slowly you end up ascending the hill. Now what happens is you end up on the top of a little hill. Now the catch with the hill climbing algorithm, it will get you, it's better than randomly choosing a solution, but if you have a landscape that has a whole bunch of hills of all different sizes in it, then getting to the top of one particular hill, I mean, that is not likely to be the best solution possible in that space. So another variation on that is say, well, instead of having just one guy doing hill climbing, let's throw 1,000 little critters into this virtual landscape, and each of them is like trying mutations of himself. And then you say, well, that might converge a little faster. And when we do this method here, it's called genetic algorithms or simulated evolution. The search method is we put a bunch of guys into the space, and what we do is each of them is doing sort of hill climbing, but we're also doing this thing. If I have like a team of 4 of them, after like 100 updates, they look at each other and say, well, who's doing the best? Let's say, well, that guy over there is doing the best. Let's say, all right, let's 2 of us go over, let's 1 of us go over to be near him, okay? And then the other guy will say, let's look at the second best doing guy. One of me will go over and be by the second best guy. Or maybe what I'll do instead, I'll do a sexual combination of number 1 and number 2, and I'll say, let's go and choose some sort of gene that's an average between the first guy and the second guy. Or let's do a crossover. Let's take half the father's gene and half the mother's gene. And that's, it's sort of a little bit of a cargo cult. There's this thing, like, supposedly the Pacific Islanders during World War II, they really hadn't seen much of modern civilizations. And they would see these army planes come in, like full, the big fat plane, and all this stuff would come out, all this food and, clothes and ammunition and guns. And they'd think, well, all you have to do is build a landing strip and the plane will come. So there are these things called cargo cults. And so they would like make something that looked like an airstrip. They would like flatten out this place on the island and put up things that looked sort of like a control tower and wait for the cargo plane to come and land and bring them all the goodies. So sometimes when I look, I used to be more optimistic about artificial life, but again, waiting for the ants to wake up and do something interesting and it never happening. You say, well, maybe we're just doing this cargo cult thing. We're saying, well, nature does crossover. It takes half the father's gene, half the mother's gene, and you end up with a good combination. Maybe doing that here with these parameters is going to give me something good. Well, this search, it doesn't seem to be provably actually that great. It's just something that we tried. In other words, evolution will search through the fitness landscape. Now, fitness landscape, that's an expression I haven't defined yet. Let me say a little bit about it. And this is all stuff that's in the second half of chapter 2. Let's put a different one up just for fun. let's just put something random up. Let's just randomize everything, see what happens. Okay. Ooh, that doesn't look so good. Let's randomize everything again. And I don't like that one either. This is where just recent... Oh, well. Oh, I know, there's a real good one. The owls are good. Let's open the parameters. Again, birdcage, I seem to remember the owls being pretty good. Let's look at the owls. Yeah, they're pretty nice. These are a little bit funkier than the birds. Half the time they act like, they have like six internal states. So rather than having one parameter set, they have like six different ways that they can fly. And they will adjust that as time goes by. These are really kind of beautiful patterns. Let's do something to try to slow it down again. Let's put walls around the world. Let's put more of them in there. Let's do it. And one other thing. Let's give them thick lines. Let's give them all thin lines. All right, let's do that. Okay. So let's leave that going for a while. Anyway, I want to talk about the fitness landscape. So we could think of this sort of plane, that this is what we think about of the state space. So we have the state space, usually we draw it as two-dimensional just so we can draw a picture, but really, if you think of like your DNA, you know, there might be millions of different things you could change on your DNA, so you'd really want this sort of million-dimensional search space. Or even these guys, they have genes that are maybe 100 bits long, so it'd be sort of a 100-dimensional search space. But we just draw a picture state space. And then we say, think of fitness as being the height. Now, in this world, fitness, this purple stuff is poison, and the gold stuff is food. So you want to eat the gold stuff and not eat the poison. And the green guys want to bump into the blue guys and not bump into the red guys. And they're all keeping track of how fit they are. And so we say, okay, depending where I am in the state space, how fit am I? Well, if your landscape has a single bump in it, then hill climbing is going to do fine for you. Okay, but what happens, what we notice about computations, usually if you change like one bit in the code, it can have a really dramatic change in how fit that thing is. So the fitness landscape is more in the nature of just being this hideously, like a bed of nails. Just unbelievably spiky, okay? And so in a landscape like this, hill climbing is not going to get you very far. It'll get you to the top of one of these little things, but in terms of finding the highest point, it won't do it for you. Now, this is why any kind of search procedure does very poorly in these kinds of worlds that are called rugged fitness landscapes. And what we've kind of found out about genes or computer variations, the landscapes, most of them are rugged in that fairly small changes in your genes can end up being lethal, so it can have this very big effect. So how is it that evolution works then? Why does it work if it's so hard to find the highest point? Well, here's the deal. You don't have to find the best point. Before I lived here, I lived in a small town of Virginia called Lynchburg. When I got to California, I'd get like the metro, and it would say the best restaurants. And I'd be, look, I'm coming here from Lynchburg. If I can just find a reasonably good restaurant, if I can find some place that's, you know, not the Holiday Inn restaurant, you know, or some place that's not a Denny's, you know, or I can find like any restaurant that where they would have dim lights, you know, and a tablecloth, I would be pretty happy. So it's this idea, if we expect too much, then you're never going to be happy. But the point is, there are lots of reasonably good solutions in the landscape. And it's not like the way that humans are, we're, you know, fairly funky looking. And there's no reason to think that we're the best possible form that a two-legged animal could have, you know. There could be other quite different configurations that we could have ended up in that would have done just as well. So it's really not the case that the entire, you know, huge billion-dimensional space of genetic possibilities was searched to come up with us, the crown of creation. You know, the another thing to keep in mind, it might even be there's fairly many reasonably good peaks in the fitness landscape. So you say, well, how could something as wonderful as us have evolved? Maybe it's not that hard to evolve something, you know, that's reasonably good. That's the whole thing. It's the problem that we're trying to solve here, it's not that we're looking for a complete optimization. We're just looking for something that's reasonably good. Okay. Now, we still have the big issue of trying to find artificial life that evolves in an interesting way. And there's an interesting book by a guy called Rodney Brooks at MIT. And he made he made some really nice little robots over the years, and he's still doing it. He wrote a book called Flesh and Machines. And in there, he kind of says, well, you know, it hasn't really worked out as well as we dreamed in the early days of artificial life. It's things aren't evolving and becoming, you know, as super as we wanted them to as quickly. And at this point, we're not quite sure why. The sense is that my guess is that we don't have enough morphogenesis in the kinds of things we're doing. These things I was showing you now, these sort of ants and birds in the Boppers program, they have a little bit of morphogenesis in that the shape of that creature, the shape of the trail he uses, leaves, that is his coat. But we don't have that kind of morphogenesis like a tissue that's growing itself. So I think we'd want to see things that were more like Jabotinsky, three-dimensional Jabotinsky scrolls growing themselves and doing stuff. So that is one possibility to keep in mind. Okay. Another thing we're going to be talking about, probably not next week, and pretty soon we're going to be talking about, anyway, in Chapter 4, one of the topics in Chapter 4, is another place that we're trying to use evolution is in trying to find artificial intelligence. Because here, with artificial life, what the game is about, it's more a visual game. You're trying to get something that acts lifelike and interesting. And we're looking at robots, we're looking at, like the non-player characters in video games, it'd be nice if they were a little more lifelike. In artificial intelligence, we're trying to find stuff that acts smart. And it's, again, a situation where you have an idea for how to do it, but then there'll be a lot of parameters you need to set, and you don't know what numbers to use there. And one way to go about looking for the best number is to do something like evolution. So we're actually going to come back to simulated evolution again in Chapter 4. So that's about it for now. Let's take a break.